What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I think that the entire aid sector was a little bit in denial, to be quite honest with you, between the time that we knew Trump had won the election and the time that he took office. I think everybody was aware that the situation would likely become a bit more difficult and that there would likely be some types of programs that were deprioritized or some countries that were deprioritized, similarly to what we had seen under the previous Trump administration. But I think nobody was prepared for the first thing that the administration went after to be USAID, and nobody was prepared for it to be literally everything that Project 2025 had laid out, like an entire gutting of the entire agency and folding it into state. And so there weren't any sort of kind of contingency plans, which is kind of ironic since that's kind of what we're supposed to do for a living around the world, and we didn't have any for ourselves.
Today, I'm bringing you my interview with Cecilia Thiam, a 35-year-old Swiss-American humanitarian aid worker who has spent most of her career living and working in sub-Saharan Africa. She lost her job after the Trump administration enacted sweeping cuts to the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. We spoke on July 10, 2025. This is part of a theme I'm pursuing, looking at how the Trump administration is affecting people's personal finances. If you know someone who would be a great guest, get in touch at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com or on Instagram or TikTok at It's Maya Money. I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people how much money they make and how their finances work so that the questions we all have about money can be a little bit less of a mystery. And now, here's my interview with Cecilia Thiam. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is that part of what I'm focusing on for this season is people who have been directly impacted by the Trump administration's various policies. In this case, his cuts to USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. So I'm curious to hear, what did the cuts to USAID look like for you?
It impacted my life in so many ways, so many. It impacted me on a very personal level. I lost my job immediately because of the cuts. It impacted almost every one of my friends in that they lost their jobs, and people in various life circumstances and in various places around the world. I joke, but like sinisterly with my friends, that going on LinkedIn up until now remains like going to a cemetery almost of lost jobs and of looking for work. But also as somebody, as I've kind of described myself as, that's been doing this my whole life and for whom this is really like a passion, to see the impact also that, you know, $43 billion in less funding has for people on the ground. And so, I mean, I'm currently in Sudan. For the past couple of months, I've been in Congo, working on kind of both of these really big crises at the moment. In the Congo, U.S. funding made up 77% of the entire response, or maybe it was 70% of the entire response, humanitarian and development. And in Sudan, it was 44%. The impact of the loss of programming takes a little bit of time to be seen. For instance, malnutrition rates going up doesn't happen overnight. It takes weeks, if not months. Similarly, with disease outbreaks, they're seasonal. And so if medicines aren't being delivered, you might not see today that there is a mass uptick in measles or malaria or, you know, easily preventable diseases, but you will down the road once rains hit or dry seasons hit or different peak seasons hit. And I think there, similarly, we've seen a lot in the news about, you know, PEPFAR programming being ended. I think that's also a really great example where you're not going to see people necessarily dying tomorrow of HIV/AIDS, but if they no longer have access to antiretrovirals, then months down the line, all of a sudden, what was a totally contained virus becomes something that can actually be deadly and wipe out millions of people.
So you said you lost your job once the USAID funding was cut. Where were you working at the time?
So I actually, in many ways, was in a fortunate position at the time because I was in Washington, D.C. So of my almost 15-year field career, I took 1 year this past year to go to the U.S. My family lives in the U.S. I wanted my 6-year-old daughter to meet her grandparents and uncles and aunts and spend time. And so I was working with an NGO called Interaction, which is basically a coalition of international NGOs that have a base in the U.S. that do both development and humanitarian work.
So how much money were you making at that job?
I was making about $145,000 a year.
Okay. And is the reason you lost your job in part because most of that organization's funding came from USAID?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I think it's probably somewhere between a third and a half of the organization's funding that came from USAID. However, I was working on the humanitarian team for which 100% of the funding was coming from USAID. And we were particularly unlucky, I suppose, in that our grant ended 2 weeks after Trump was elected. So even though we had the things in the pipeline for the next year of the project, we weren't in the same case as others where the grant was put on hold and then it was resumed down the road. It ended and it just was never extended.
So walk me through the timeline from when there was a freeze put on the funding for USAID. But as I understand it, that effectively cut off programs like yours, because if there's a freeze or a pause, organizations can't continue to function. So when did this happen and how quickly did this happen?
Gosh, now I'll have to try to remember, but January 20th, Trump is sworn in. Within that first week, we were already being told that the grants were going to be cut, that no more programs would be approved. Colleagues at USAID were losing their jobs or were being sent home and were being basically put on administrative leave. Again, being in DC, where I was really close to all of this. And so you would see colleagues that would be walking into the BHA builder, the USAID buildings, and then would be returning because their badges had been revoked. And they were not necessarily even informed. So they were walking to work like it was a regular day. And then it was all of a sudden just like, sorry, you no longer have a job. Please go home and let's see what happens. There are some organizations that were 100% funded by BHA that were fairly small, that didn't have reserves, that hadn't been able to draw down money, that were like, okay, we can do this for 2-3 weeks, and then we have to close. Another really important and interesting point about that is that the labor laws in countries look very different. And so in the U.S., unfortunately for workers, it's much easier to let people go without very much notice. But for organizations that have programs overseas, even if they knew that they didn't have the reserves to be able to pay their staff, labor laws in places like Senegal, for instance, don't allow you to lay someone off with no notice. You have 5 weeks maybe of notice, and then there's a severance obligation. And so there were many organizations that really freaked out. Many of them were in the middle of their project implementation. And so on one hand, you had those who were saying, well, let's ride this out and let's see what happens. And theoretically, the money's already been obligated. They can't not give it to us. So let's use our own funds to bridge the gap. And then there were those that said, we don't have enough of a cushion. And so as a result, we basically need to close up shop or significantly reduce the workforce.
So January, Trump is sworn into office. In February, the cuts are coming. And then by what point are you like, well, I don't have any work anymore and I need to find a new job?
I'd say the week after Trump was sworn in, we were all given our notice, but we all still had until the end of February, a month for all intents and purposes, to sort out what handover might look like, which was 20 years of work that just disappeared, and to look for new work while we were still getting a salary.
You have a 6-year-old daughter. You're living in D.C. And do you have a partner?
Not one that contributes financially into my life at all.
Okay. So what is the calculus at that point for you of what to do?
I panicked. Even though, I mean, I've told you how much I made, that sounds like it's a lot of money. It is a lot of money, but also living in DC is shockingly expensive. And six-year-olds are a lot more expensive than I would have thought. And yeah. So I was not putting a ton of money on the side. And certainly what I was putting on the side is not liquid. It's things that are going into retirement and college accounts. And so I was like, I don't even have enough money to make my life work for a month in this current configuration.
What was your rent in DC?
It's $3,000 a month before utilities for a tiny little apartment. So we're in the middle of a school year. I had just uprooted my kid who'd been living with me in Congo for the last 4 years. I'd uprooted her that year to start school. And so I'm like, well, am I going to, in the middle of the school year, uproot her again? And if so, to go where? The lease in my apartment, I couldn't get out of. So I'm like, even if I don't live here anymore, I still have to pay for it. So why would I not stay living here? The cost of living in DC is crazy. And so I panicked. But again, because I had this like window of a few weeks before everybody started realizing how bad this was going to be, I basically was like, I'm going to apply to everything and something will stick. And then in my case, two things stuck. And I just like worked two jobs for 4 months until the school year ended to just, I guess, also learn from that mistake and say, never again will I be in a position where I don't even have enough to be able to get me through a month of my life with my child.
So you got through the end of the school year, and then what did you do?
Then one of these consultancies has become a bit longer term. So as I was mentioning earlier, I'm in Sudan.
You're living in Sudan?
I'm living in Kenya, working in Sudan. I'm in Nairobi at the moment.
Okay.
So one of these consultancies has turned into, for the moment, it's a 9-month additional commitment. And I guess I just kind of took the gamble. I had no reason to be in DC. I don't have family in DC. Without a job, there's exactly no reason for me to be in DC. And I moved my life to Nairobi. And so we live in Nairobi with no stability financially at all beyond these 9 or 10 months now, I suppose, of consultancy, but where I just feel as though the quality of life is better, where I can save more, and where also, I mean, some of the other effects of the Trump administration might hit a little bit less hard.
What is rent like in Nairobi?
I'm living in an apartment now that is bigger than the one that I had in DC, still 2-bedroom, 2-bathroom, and it is fully furnished, all expenses included, including cleaning, for $900 a month.
When people hear, you know, the rent that you're paying sounds great, right? But then when you're living in a place like Nairobi, but you're from the US/Switzerland, there are all these things that if you want them, they cost a lot of money, like school or like certain products you might want to buy. And I'm guessing it's a private school that you will have to pay for.
Yes.
And do you know how much that is for the normal school year?
About 9,000 for the school year.
9,000
US dollars.
Yeah. I mean, that is not nothing.
Like health insurance, because as a consultant, we don't get health insurance. And so international health insurance that's going to cover me, like if I need to go back to the US, costs a fortune.
How much is it?
It's about $1,000 a month for the two of us. So it's a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are a lot of expenses. And yes, some things are a lot cheaper. Transportation is a lot cheaper and housing is a lot cheaper. Food is not really that much cheaper. The kind of household things are not really that much cheaper. And then again, there's not a public school system that we can benefit from in the same way. And public services look different. And, you know, very basic things. Trash removal is not a free service. You can't drink running water, so you have to buy water on a regular basis.
Right. It all adds up. So it maybe overall it is still cheaper than living in the US, but there are so many things that you have to pay for that a person living in the US would never even think twice about.
Like security guards, you have to have a security guard in your compound. That's just the thing that one has to do here.
And is that included in your rent?
In my case, it is, yeah.
So is your idea that you'll do this consultancy and then see what happens?
So I've actually intentionally kept this current contract as a consultancy rather than a staff position to allow me the flexibility to do other things on the side. And I'm also looking at investing the small inheritance that I've received in the past year, which was originally going to buy a house for me and my daughter in DC or Baltimore, which now is absolutely out of the question, into a different project that I've been thinking about for years, but some sort of a small bed and breakfast type of thing somewhere on the coast here.
Oh, wow. And can you say how much that inheritance was?
Yeah, it's about $200,000 US.
And how much are you making now as a consultant?
I don't know exactly the calculation of taxes since I have to pay them on myself, but $12,000 a month.
Okay. And it is so interesting that, as you were saying, the whole job of what you had been doing in humanitarian aid, in part, is contingency planning, is like, how do we look into the future and make sure that we have plans so that when a disaster hits or when something happens, people have resources. And yet, the very organizations doing that work didn't have their own contingency plans, didn't diversify their income enough so that the cutting off of money from USAID wouldn't affect them. And it sounds like that is now something you're taking into your own life of never have only one source of income.
Yep, 100%. Maybe this is a little philosophical, but I feel like the world is changing entirely. And I feel like the things that I thought to be true up until now feel untrue in many, many different spheres of my life and the world, but finances being one of them. Mm-hmm. So I kind of grew up in the school of thought that, you know, if you work really hard in school and if you get a bunch of degrees and if you get degrees from reputable organizations and if you work your way up, then you will be fine. And so for me, I did all of those things and I got exactly where I wanted to be on my kind of career trajectory. I had a five-year plan. I knew exactly what I was going to do. And it never occurred to me that I could lose my job because I work my butt off to excel. And so it just, for me, that was always enough. That was always the metric. And so I think in part, there was this enormous feeling of loss, not just the loss of my job and the loss of what this meant to people in the field and what this meant for the system, but also just loss of this idea where I'm like, the things that I studied for and the skills that I have, I don't know what they are applicable to anymore. I don't know how to turn them into a revenue anymore. And that is shocking to me. And so it was also this like loss of a dream, of a passion for what I was doing, and a kind of profound sense of like having been hoodwinked, of like I did everything that I was supposed to do. How did I end up here?
It's a loss of your resume mattering.
Well, and I mean, now, again, I mean, I'm immensely grateful for the things that I'm doing now, but they are not at all in line with this career trajectory that I was on. It's work that I would have done in more junior positions than where I was in my career. And so, I mean, that's also been really humbling to just kind of swallow your ego and say, you know what, all of this privilege that I've been holding for so long, like maybe it's time to revisit it and just say, at the end of the day, I am making good money. I'm able to live in this beautiful home in Nairobi with my daughter. And okay, so I have to report to people that normally would have reported to me. Okay. But it's a big mindset shift.
What did you learn from your parents, if anything, about money, indirectly or directly?
I think I learned two things from them. I think on one hand, because they chose not particularly lucrative careers, at least up until their 50s.
What did they do?
My dad worked at a used bookstore, and my mom for a long time worked at a coffee shop, and then she worked at a Montessori school as a preschool teacher. And so I think on one hand, I learned a lot about like budgeting and saving. But on the other hand, I also had this kind of opposite swing of like, I don't want to do that. I want to do something that will afford me the type of lifestyle that I want to have and that will afford my child that type of lifestyle. And I truly believed that a career in international relations would be that. But at the end of the day, to still be able to say, this is a career choice that will allow me to combine the things that I care about with the type of salary that I need to live the type of life that I'd like to live.
Yeah. Where is family for you and your daughter in the world, but also how does that factor into the way that you view your financial future, where you want to be? You know, family costs money, travel to see family costs money. How do you think about all of that as you think about what you're going to do next in your financial life?
Well, our family is all over the place. So my parents are in New Jersey in the U.S. My brother is in New Jersey, U.S. My sister is in New Mexico. My daughter's dad is based in Central African Republic, but from Senegal, Mauritania. And then my mom's whole side of the family, with whom I'm very close, are all based in Geneva, Switzerland. So the places that we have to go are multiple, right? And that's a budget. But I think kind of to that point, two things. One is that my immediate family is particularly important to me at this stage in life. I think since I've had my daughter, and also now, since we've spent this year and a half closer to them, that is more important to me than it was before. And also seeing my parents' parents pass away and the way that they and their siblings became much closer has also really impacted the way that I view my relationship to my siblings, to my parents, my daughter's relationship to them. And so that proximity is really important to me. I think also because our family is all over the place and because I've moved around so much and that's the life that I'm giving to my daughter too, the idea of a place that's stable is really important to me also. And identifying where that place is, investing in that, and then that also being, you know, another potential travel piece, because if that place is to be Kenya, for example, then we've just added another place to the list of places I have to go. Versus if it's the US, which was the plan originally, with the purpose of having like a space that's close to my family. I mean, that idea is anyways largely dead in the water at this point. But even if it weren't, then that still doesn't really solve my problem of having stability here on the exact opposite side of the world.
Right.
I should just also say, so I think for my daughter, it's also really important for me that because my family has such a big presence in her life, that she has a strong connection to the African continent as well. And so I think having some sort of a base here, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's in Senegal or elsewhere, but this base on this continent is also really important to me for her future.
And does her dad travel to come see you guys?
He hasn't in 2 years.
So it's kind of like you have to pay to go see him.
Yes. That is how it has been for, yes, some time now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough. And what has this been like for your daughter? The moving, the uncertainty, does that register in her?
Yeah, I mean, I think because it's just the two of us, we're very close. And so I think that she picks up on my emotions in ways that are kind of uncanny sometimes. I think on one hand, she's used to moving. And again, because we're very, very close, she's okay. But I think that particularly in this transitional time in January, February, March, she was acting out a lot. She wasn't sleeping normally. She went into the strange phase of lying, which maybe is age-related, but I would tend to think is more just acting out because I think my behavior was totally off. I was not paying any attention to her. Not attention, but I wasn't focused on her because I was so worried about how am I going to make ends meet. And so I think now actually we've gotten to Nairobi a week ago, but I feel like this week is the first week where I'm starting to see kind of really normal behavior again of just like, okay, so we're both back into this sort of routine of, you know, we watch our movie together, we have our dinner together, we chit chat about school or whatever. And she seems to be doing really well.
So I want to also just go back to the moment that you were realizing that you had to leave DC, which you had thought could be a home base for you. And then, you know, job cut, got to move. What did that also look like for your neighbors, for your friends? Was the entire mood just like, we've all got to get out of here? Because I imagine you have a lot of friends who are also in your same type of industry.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not in the real estate field, so I'm not an expert here, but it did seem to me that the amount of for sale houses on my block, in my neighborhood, in DC, went astronomically up in the last couple of months. And so I'd say about half of my friends, my DC-based friends, lost their jobs. I'd say of that half, a quarter of them went back to live with family. And another quarter looked at moving in with one another. So either with a partner or with a friend that still had a job. And I think what was particularly striking in the moment around leaving DC was that it was just this kind of overwhelming sense of hopelessness where it's not just our industry. It's not just USAID, but it's so many other things too. Like, for instance, the public school system in DC was coming under attack. And so I had been thinking like, oh, maybe I could go and be a teacher. Well, no, that doesn't feel safe. I mean, I had neighbors that had to move out or in some cases sell their condos, but also that we had neighbors that were assisted through government programs and whose rent was paid through government programs and who were on assistance programs like SNAP, who all of a sudden were like, oh my gosh, in the next couple of months, this isn't going to be viable anymore. And how am I going to send my son to school? Or how am I going to put a roof over his head? It felt like it was this kind of like snowball that started with USAID and that started with the people in this industry. And then that set off kind of a chain reaction where it was like, what are we supposed to do? And when is there going to be a moment when this all feels less hopeless? So yeah, it's an overarching sense of profound unsettledness, I think.
Right. And even when there is a fallback or, you know, a cushion that you can use, as you're saying, it doesn't last forever. And it also doesn't change the fact that in your just day-to-day life, you might feel very irritable, not your normal self in how you interact with other people. I mean, it can be very unpleasant, just the sort of interpersonal things that happen with that kind of stress.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like financial worries are one of the worst worries, at least for me. I feel like the type of anxiety that's like the most debilitating for me are health and finances. And those actually are often linked, sort of, because, you know, as I'm freaking out about my finances, then I get sick.
Right.
But so sure. I mean, I think that's what I was saying earlier with my daughter, too, you know, is that there were a couple of months where she definitely picked up on my behavior being really strange and where I just felt really awful.
What was your behavior?
I think I was, like I said, I was distracted. So I wasn't spending the type of time that I wanted to with her. I was really panicked. And so small things would take so much longer for me because my brain wasn't focusing on them. And then I would go in this like spiral of, well, it took me so long to do this and now I haven't done this. And it's just kind of this vicious circle of anxiety, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have debt?
No.
And how at this point are you thinking about saving, investing, planning for the future? How does going through this massive shift in job and career and the industry changing, how does that affect just your ability to do things like save?
Well, I think psychologically it affects it a lot in that now I think about everything a lot more than I used to. So like, do I really need to buy this thing? I mean, even moving here, I was like, well, I could get an unfurnished apartment and furnish it so it's my style. And then I'm like, I absolutely don't need to do that because that is not an efficient use of resources. And so I think now, in a way that I would formerly have been like, I'll put a little bit aside and it'll be fine. Now I'm like, okay, I need to actively put aside, and I've made like budgets for myself where I'm like, this is exactly what I'm allowed to spend this month. This is my like leeway in case this month is a little bit more fun or less fun or whatever. But there is an absolute minimum of like, in fact, I've set it up such that the portion of my payment goes directly into an account that I cannot touch to force me to use these 9 months of good salary to save a little bit of a nest egg.
How much is it, a percentage, or is it a dollar amount that's just directly being funneled into that savings account?
The dollar amount is $4,000.
A month?
A month.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's a great savings amount.
$3,000 go into a savings account, $1,000 go into a retirement account. And then there's actually an additional $500 that go monthly into my daughter's college account. So it's $4,500, excuse me.
And that's always better when it's already being deducted from the amount that you can spend. You don't see
it.
You don't get to touch it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think a lot more about things like retirement now, because I think, you know, my parents have also been really freaked out by all of this, where they're like, well, do we lose our Social Security? And what does that mean for our ability to retire? And, you know, similarly to your question to me about how I envisage family and traveling, I think for them, it's equally important to be able to visit their three children in the different parts of the world that they are. And for my mom, her mother is still alive. And so to visit her in Switzerland. And so I think seeing their anxiety about what does it mean to reach retirement age and be uncertain whether or not you will have healthcare and Social Security has made me kind of also think a lot differently about what retirement looks like, and also what like legacy sort of money looks like for my daughter, so that also there's something that when I'm not around anymore, she has.
What do you indulge in? What is something that it sort of doesn't really matter how much it costs, you just really want to buy it?
I think there's a couple of things. I think traveling is definitely one of them. My daughter and I just went on a little vacation to Greece. And that's the type of moment where I'm like, I'm not even going to look at what things cost. Like this vacation, I'm not looking at a bill, credit card, and I'll figure it out afterwards. And then I guess the other is, this was like this terrible habit that was, or habit coping mechanism that a colleague of mine gave me when I was like 17, but when I'm not feeling well, this idea of retail therapy. So it'll be going to like this, I love the shop Anthropology. And if I'm having a really terrible day, I'm just gonna be like, okay, I'm gonna buy myself a dress today or a new pair of shoes. And I mean, it's not that I don't care what it costs at all, but I mean, I know more or less what the cost bracket is. And so that will be my other kind of guilty pleasure.
What is the cost bracket?
It's usually probably around $200 for either a dress or a pair of shoes.
Uh-huh. And is that online or you're going in person when you can?
It's online because most of the time, like, first of all, I'm working all the time, but also this is like when I'm tired and I'm feeling terrible, it's at like the middle of the night where I'm like, I really need this one thing to make me feel
better. To look
better.
At pretty things.
Yes. And then in the morning, I'm like, oh my gosh, Cecilia, why have you done that? But
yeah. What does the concept of enough look like to you?
Mm-hmm. This is a huge conversation in my family. My sister is very much into this idea that we hoard wealth.
That you hoard wealth in your family? Or
no,
people?
I mean, I think that people do, and to be careful not to. That's kind of like what society has instilled us to do. And even this idea, like I've just been describing, of like wanting to build a financial legacy
plan.
And all of that. Yeah, I mean, there is this sense of like, oh my gosh, what happens? There isn't enough, so we're hoarding wealth. We've actually had a lot of conversations about this, again, around inheritance, because it's split amongst the three of us, where my sister...
Where was the inheritance from?
Grandparents that died and businesses that they had, both on my mom and dad's side.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, she was saying that the whole idea of an inheritance is kind of gross, or like my dad sat us down and was like, okay, if you'd like, you could use our financial advisor. It'd be free of charge. All three of you could talk to him and just get a couple of like tips on how to invest. And my sister was like, well, this whole thing is a little bit gross because, I mean, we have more than enough. And why do we need to hoard this? And why do we need to plan? And I mean, she fully understands the other argument, but I think it's a really interesting question. And so I think, I mean, enough, I think I have more than enough of all the things. And so I think that to me is not necessarily, I don't know that I look at it that way. I certainly have never looked at something as in like, I don't have enough of, so I must. I think it's more the contrary, where like I have too much of, and so I must kind of reduce or give back. Not that I need more, if that makes sense.
But do you have enough financial stability?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Probably not, no. I do feel as though 6 months ago you would have asked me this and I probably would have said yes, because I felt more secure in what my life was going to look like. And now I don't have any less financial security, like in terms of assets, than I did then. But now I would say, no, I don't, because I have no idea what things look like. And because I'm like, well, if I end up not having a job for 5 years, then what?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a hard question, especially when you have kids, because you need to be responsible and think about their well-being in a really long-term way. It really changes the calculus, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that, again, was something that was really shocking to me in my reaction to this whole losing my job. Because if I didn't have a kid, I would have packed a backpack and I would have gone and done something totally different. Who knows where? But you don't have that flexibility with a kid. And so then I was like, I also don't want her to suffer from this. And that even if she still has a school and a roof and food, I don't want the quality of her life to be less than it's been up until now. Me, I don't necessarily care. Mm-hmm. But I don't want her to live in a small.
But you also don't want her. Yeah, you also don't want her to live with a mom who's stressed out and distracted.
Also, yep.
You know, like,
Yeah.
Cecilia, thank you so much for being here. It's been really great to talk to you, and I appreciate your candor and just how you are thinking about all this. So thank you so much.
Thank you as well. Thank you for hosting me.
This episode was edited, produced, and mixed by Lane Kaplan-Levinson. Thank you to Pushkin Industries for past production support. If you know someone who would make a great guest on this show, please let me know. Email me at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com or find me on Instagram and TikTok at It's Maya Money. And as always, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. See you soon.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.